Hello and welcome back to the KPMG Financial Reporting Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Tricarci. We're seeing a surge of high-profile IPOs planned to hit the market and a deep pipeline of companies lining up behind them. Plus, there's a very clear signal from the SEC that its mission is to make IPOs great again. So what does all that mean? Well, I think that infamous IPO window that we've talked about on this podcast before is fully open. But as we all know, it can slam shut quickly. And the last thing you want to be is on the outside looking in because you were scrambling to get your financial statements in order. And for private equity portfolio companies in particular, that means being, quote, exit ready at all times. And that's what we're focusing on this episode, that eventual exit, whether it's an IPO, a sale, or another path, and how that drives every critical decision in a portfolio company's financial reporting lifecycle. And there's no one better to guide us through it than my guest today, Nick Bergmeier. Nick is a partner in our national office who literally wrote the book on this when he published our thought-leading piece called From Acquisition to Exit, which goes through the entire accounting journey of a portco. So he's here to explain why your accounting needs to be aligned with that exit long before the window opens. Now, here's my conversation with Nick. Nick Bergmeier, welcome to the podcast.
It's great to be here. Longtime listener.
Well, you know, the only thing better than one Nick is two Nicks.
That's right.
So we're leveling up the podcast already. And we've got an awesome topic today. Nick, you wrote a fantastic publication back in November about portfolio companies, the life cycle of a portfolio company, a lot of the key accounting issues and decisions that need to be made. And I want to dive into that with you over the next 30 minutes. But before we get into that, I've got a little riddle for you.
That's a surprise.
What do portfolio companies and me going to my in-laws for the holidays have in common?
They're looking for an exit.
It's all about the exit strategy. Exactly. Because really, a portfolio company is just a private company that's owned by a PE fund, right? And if there's a PE fund owner, then they're looking to exit and monetize their investment, generate a return, and have management participate in that. And that's where I want to start. I want to start at the exit, at the end, because it's the whole point of these things. And it actually does, I think, have a lot of influence with how certain contracts are set up and some accounting decisions that, you know, those types of companies should be thinking about from the very beginning when they get that initial PE investment. So with that, let's just take the S1, for example, especially now. IPO market's open, a lot of IPOs happening. So if that's the exit path, what does that mean from an accounting and reporting standpoint?
Yeah, I mean, just like any company going public, right? I mean, what it's going to require is that you're going to have SEC compliant financial statements. And compared to the reporting when you're a private company, we always sort of refer to it as an uplift, if you will, from private company reporting to SEC reporting. So that could be just that there's certain U.S. GAAP requirements that are different between a private and public company. Like one example would be public companies have to do segment reporting. They have to do EPS, earnings per share. And those are things that they don't have to deal with as a private company. But then even a private company might adopt what are called private company accounting alternatives. The most famous or maybe infamous one would be the amortization of goodwill.
Yep.
And when you need public company financial statements, you can't apply those policies or alternatives. And what you have to do is unwind all of that in order to make your financial statements uplifted or compliant from an SEC reporting perspective. And I guess the other thing to keep in mind, it's not just the financial reporting considerations that might be different, but the audit opinion is even going to be different for those financial statements, right? Because that audit's going to need to be conducted under public company or PCAOB standards, as well as portcos are going to start to need to establish and be able to certify their disclosure controls and internal controls over financial reporting to be compliance with Sarbanes-Oxley.
Yeah, and that, I mean, that effort both on uplifting the financials themselves and the audit can be extensive, right?
Absolutely.
So good that we're talking about this, thinking about the exit on day one and basically trying to set yourself up for the smoothest transition
possible. That's right, because if you, for example, right, you're pretty sure you're going to do a IPO as an exit, or that's a really likely scenario, you probably don't want to adopt some of those private company alternatives just because it's going to cause you headaches on the back end. There's a lot of other things you'd like to be spending your time on.
Yeah, and the other big, you know, most common path that we see is the strategic sale.
Yep.
And I think this could put you in a very similar boat to what we just talked about, if a public company, right? That is the acquirer. Yep. That's going to trigger a lot of the same things that we just talked about, SEC compliant financial statements, et cetera, et cetera. So if you think you are going to go IPO or sell to a public company, probably give a second thought to whether you're going to adopt those private company alternatives, right?
That's right.
All right. So let's rewind the clock now. We'll go memento style, work backwards the front, and let's start from the beginning. From the moment, you know, a private company becomes a portfolio company, meaning a private equity firm comes in and invests money, you know, perhaps acquires all the stock or a portion of it or what have you. The structure of these transactions and those initial acquisitions can be incredibly complex, right?
It's always very complex, but usually what we'll see in place somewhere in the structure is that the PE firm will utilize, or the fund will utilize, a newco and capitalize that newco in order to acquire the target business.
Yeah, and that leads perfectly into the first major accounting event for a portfolio company, right? Which is accounting for this PE investment and figuring out, was there a change in control? And if so, who is the accounting acquirer? Every time we talk about newcos in that context, it gets really judgmental really quickly to figure out if the newco could potentially be the accounting acquirer or if you've got to look through it, right? So maybe just talk about some things that could make that newco the accounting acquirer. What are we looking for there?
The determination of when this newco is substantive and can be the acquirer is pretty judgmental, and sometimes it does seem like it's more art than science, but I'll just give you a couple things that we typically try to look for that might indicate the newco is the accounting acquirer and it's substantive. So does that newco survive? So does it become the reporting entity? Does it survive the transaction?
Meaning that legal entity still exists after the acquisition.
Yep. Okay. The second thing we sort of look for, and are there things that would be considered substantive pre-combination activities? And this could be as, you know, simple as raising debt to fund the acquisition. It could be people making, you know, identifying acquisition targets, or really anything else. And sort of the last bucket is understanding the purpose and design and really the governance of the newco, and seeing that the governance of that newco is really a different entity than the target.
Yeah. Anytime we're dealing with any accounting standard that involves indicators and weighing them, it's highly fact specific and judgmental. So let me ask you this. Who cares? So what? why does it matter if the newco is substantive and therefore likely the accounting acquirer? Like, what does that mean for the financial statements?
So if that newco is the accounting acquirer and substantive, it's required to perform acquisition accounting, which means that the target company's assets and liabilities are now going to be stepped up to fair value. So you're going to have your intangible assets that weren't there before. You might even have some goodwill.
Yep.
Right? And what also tends to happen is, from a presentation standpoint, if these financial statements of the newco ever went into an SEC filing, you're going to have what's called predecessor successor financial statements with a black line down the middle. So the predecessor period will be the target company prior to the acquisition and prior to the step up. The black line represents the second of the step up, and the successor period will be the post-acquisition financial statements of the target company after acquisition accounting is applied to it. So the reason why the black line's there is because they're not really comparable because of that new basis
Yeah, one's at cost, one's at fair value.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay. So let's take the inverse. What if the new co is not substantive? What does that mean?
So that target company then actually doesn't have to do anything. But if they choose to, the FASB has said that if a single entity or parent company obtains control,
yep,
you can push down the acquisition accounting that the parent has done or would be required to do if they did their own financial statements to that portfolio company or to that target company. Now, what does that mean? Well, it basically means you kind of get to the same spot as if the new co was the acquirer, because you're going to have, again, that black line presentation. You're going to have a step up in basis of your assets and liabilities, and that starting from the acquisition date, it's going to be sort of like there's a new reporting entity with, and they don't use this words, but I'm going to, sort of like a fresh start.
Yep. So super simple example, just to maybe bring this full circle. You've got the private equity fund. Let's just assume they buy 100% of the company to keep it easy.
Sure.
So you've got the private equity fund at the top. Let's say there's a new co that survived. And then you have the old portfolio company, the operating company,
yep,
underneath. If NewCo is not substantive, then you're looking above it. So right. Private equity fund, in my example, you're saying, did they obtain control? If so, did the accounting acquire?
Yep.
Now, what's interesting is that PE fund doesn't do purchase accounting, right? Because they're just accounting for all their investments at fair value.
Right.
But nonetheless, the private company, the portfolio company, has an option to do this push down accounting and step up their assets and liabilities.
That's absolutely right. They even made that very clear that just because the parent, or maybe it's an individual like you or I, like that I don't prepare personal financial statements.
You don't?
I do.
Got mine off.
I actually do. but you could push down as if they did file or prepare GAAP financial statements. And this isn't like this question, Nick, even in your example of the three levels there.
Yep.
If you were, even if NewCo was substantive, if you continue to report just at the bottom company, the target company,
yep,
you'd still have this push down question.
Yep.
Right? You'd still have the push down option there. So if you just continue to report at just the target company, it only becomes a question of, do you want to do push down or not?
So figuring out who the reporting entity is going to be
very important.
Critical, right?
Yeah.
And that's probably going to be tied to some of these debt arrangements.
Absolutely.
Or who the registrant would be if this thing were to go public via an IPO. But figuring out who that reporting entity is going to be at the beginning is going to let you figure out what choices you have and where you want to go with them, right?
That's right. Like, so it typically involves a very complicated step diagram and org chart. And that's sort of the first question I ask people, like, which entity are we performing the audit on? Which one's the...
Right, exactly.
And because there's just different consequences, the different level you're reporting on. It typically does tend to follow, like you said, where the debt requirements or potential... you know, where the registration statement might be.
So if someone's listening to this and they find themselves in the bucket where they've got the choice to do push down or not,
mm-hmm,
what are the pros and cons of that decision?
I guess the cons, if you will, would just be that step up in basis, right, creates new intangibles that were never, not necessarily new intangibles, but unrecognized intangibles.
Yep.
That would get amortized, or maybe you have a step up in your inventory. So your GAAP earnings will take a bit of a hit from a net income perspective. So that's always been one reason why people didn't want to do it, is just that drag on earnings. But, you know, a lot of people are EBITDA focused, where that amortization doesn't really affect the key metrics that they're looking at. And maybe the cons of it, or the pros of it, I should say, are if you're EBITDA focused, you're not necessarily worried about the net income number, then, you know, it sort of gives you that fresh start and like clean alignment with the current owner's investment.
All right. So transitioning a little bit, I think maybe the most complicated part of a lot of these portfolio companies' accounting while they're private is compensation. And it's also probably the thing that's most closely aligned with the exit. You know, like, again, the PE fund wants to exit. They want to incentivize management to have a successful exit. And the way we see that happen is through compensation and incentive arrangements, right? So these are very complicated. They come in all shapes and sizes. But, you know, from your experience, what are the different types of compensation arrangements that PE firms typically use to incentivize the employees of the portco?
So I guess I first just want to say you're right. These are really complicated. And the most complicated compensation plans that at least I think we see are for sure portfolio company plans, right?
Agree.
And I think you hit the nail on the head that the they're usually are designed so that the management, the compensation that management receives is tied to how successful that the PE firm's exit is, right? So they'll look to give them, whether it be a share-based payment, whether it's a cash bonus, but they'll sort of tend to link that to a couple things. So one might just be service. So you have to work for a certain period of time. Another situation is it's linked to performance. So that could be something like achieving like sales growth or an earnings target. But what typically happens in these portfolio companies is these perform like a performance condition in comp accounting world, right?
Yep.
Includes things like achieving an IPO or another liquidity event, like a change of control. I would say most of the time, a portco plan has some, at least subset of compensation that is tied to a liquidity event.
Yep.
And then the other things you might sort of see is there's what we would call a market condition in the compensation world, right? Where how much shares or how many shares, I should say, are really tied to the PE firm's return. So it might be in the form of hitting a certain internal rate of return or achieving a multiple of their invested capital. But those sort of conditions in the award are very common to align the incentives, but dictate how much that that management might receive. And it's really common that they're going to have all yeah. or a combination of those things in the award.
It gets even more complicated in these portco arrangements to figure out if these share-based payments should be liability. And I think the thing we spend a lot of time focused on is the repurchase provisions that are usually always embedded in these arrangements. So can you just talk about how we think through these repurchase provisions?
Yeah. First, I guess, probably level set just a bit, right? Like, so equity classified awards under share-based payment, why that's tends to be more attractive to people is because you only measure once.
Yeah, set it and forget it.
Grant date, fair value, and you just use that measurement.
Yep.
Liability classified awards, continuous remeasurement, so you'll have mark-to-market with changes going through earnings. And that tends to be less desirable, especially for PE owners, because it creates the volatility in the income statement. So you want to just make sure you understand that, again, to sort of try to model, be able to model things out.
Yep.
There's a lot of ways awards can be a liability. But as you point out, the biggest challenge we see in portco plans are typically repurchase features. So an example of that would be if the company has an right to repurchase shares from an employee, so a call option, or an employee has the right to put the shares back to the company for cash or a put option. We have like two paragraphs in 718, right? And that guidance says, well, those repurchase features can require liability classification if the employee can avoid or it's probable the employer will prevent the employee from bearing the risks and rewards of ownership for a reasonable period of time. So that's a little mouthful.
Sounds simple.
Yeah. Risk and reward. So what does that mean? Typically, I think about that as fluctuations in fair value.
Yep.
So if the repurchase price is fair value at the date of repurchase, typically you'd say, well, okay, that's exposing to the risks and rewards of ownership. Now, a reasonable period of time. The guidance actually does provide us a bright line of it's got to be at least 6 months from the date the share is issued.
Okay.
So when I say issue, that's important. So it requires vesting. And if it's an option, that option needs to be exercised.
Okay.
Right. So those are the two things. So you got to hold the share, vested share, for a reasonable period, at least 6 months. And the purchase price should be fair value as of that date. Now, a lot of times in private company or portco plans, they just go, I do not want to ever have liability classification. So I'm going to write this agreement in a way that that is impossible. So they'll say, these shares cannot be repurchased until they're vested and outstanding for 6 months in one day. And we're going to repurchase at fair value as of that date. And if you do that, you would actually avoid liability classification. Yeah.
At least for that one feature.
At least for that, yeah. Right? Yeah. At least for that one feature. You're right.
Yeah.
Now, just because you don't build that in to your award doesn't mean you're automatically going to be a liability, but it becomes a lot trickier.
Yeah.
Especially with contingent call options. Because you have to go through a probability assessment and you could flip back and forth depending on whether it's probable that the company is going to make that exercise that call or not. Also, even if the price isn't fair value,
right,
that's sort of the big thing. So think of formula price. So you lock in a price based on earnings or something like that that's not a true fair value, and that price could technically be below fair value. Those oftentimes are going to require liability classification. You know, we could do probably a whole podcast series about just puts and then calls separately. And
well, I just recorded a podcast with Patrick and Mahesh.
Yeah.
Talking about derivatives and hedging, and puts and calls were a big part of that.
Yeah.
Slightly so different context.
Really, but, yeah. Complicated. So, you know, there's certainly a lot more flavors to the types of repurchase features that you see in these agreements.
Yeah, I mean, everything you said was obviously spot on and very thorough in terms of what we see. I guess trying to like, what's the key takeaway?
Sure.
A lot of these agreements have these repurchase provisions in them. So as you're designing these plans, this is critical that these are assessed before the agreement's finalized, because it could flip you into liability, which, as you said, most people don't want. So if the agreement says that the company or can buy these shares back for less than fair value, you're probably a liability, right?
Yeah, if it's for, that's
if it's
right
at fair value, then I think it comes down to, okay, well, when are you going to exercise that option to buy back these shares? Is it more or less than 6 months? And there's all kinds of flavors that could impact that and whether you need to assess probability and whatnot. But key takeaway, hone in on that provision, because it's going to be critical to the accounting for these awards under 718. And so I guess, Nick, if we even zoom out even more,
sure,
we started by talking about these service conditions, performance conditions, market conditions. Now we've talked about liability versus equity. So it feels like if we were to put a matrix together, there's four broad buckets of comp profiles that a portco could end up in, depending on how their terms are, you know, classified. So maybe if you could lay out what those four major profiles are that a portco could see itself end up in.
And I'm sure we could actually, if we wanted to, make a matrix of like 16, like
we need a 3D. Yeah.
But I think some pretty common scenarios that you might have. So you might have like an equity classified award that might just have a service or maybe even just a market condition. There, you're going to come up with your grant date fair value, and you're going to basically, for the most part, just recognize that compensation expense over time and oftentimes on a ratable basis.
Yep.
All right. So that's one.
Yep.
Now, think about the same sort of vesting conditions. but liability classified. So you're going to have the same timing of recognition. It's just you're going to be remeasuring every year. Okay. Now, another scenario would be, okay, well, it's equity classified, but nothing's going to vest until a liquidity event. So we have a performance condition. GAAP says only recognize that when it's probable. And really interestingly is GAAP.
Another bright line.
Also, we sort of have a fairly bright line, pretty bright line in, for these types of awards where we say an IPO change of control type of performance condition isn't probable until it happens.
Yep.
So you're not recognizing any expense until the exit. Then it's going to be a big one.
Right.
Because it's all going to hit at once. But again, if it's equity classified, you measure it at grant date, which might be several years before the exit, but you take the charge at the exit.
Yeah.
Now, another scenario would be same sort of exit performance condition, but it's liability classified. So there, same thing. You're not going to recognize anything until the exit, but because it's liability classified and going to be remeasured, it's going to be the fair value as of the exit date or the date that it vests. And that's going to be probably a bigger charge,
right?
Most likely,
you
because
would hope,
of that.
Right?
Hopefully,
yeah.
Because of that, assuming the value goes up, it's going to be a bigger charge. Again, it could be all sorts of scenarios. Oftentimes, the awards will have maybe all four. You know, service only, performance only. Then there'll be a combination of service and performance, or service or performance. So again, some of these that vest on an IPO or change of control might have service requirements afterwards. So there'd be like a key and catch and then some post combination, or so post IPO.
Yep.
So we could really make this out to several scenarios, but I think when you're thinking about the during the period where the portco is held by private equity, those four that we laid out are pretty common for the accounting during that time period.
And those are pretty stark, you know, like one is your booking comp expense during that period.
Yep.
And the amount might fluctuate depending on its equity or liability. The other is you're not booking anything,
right?
Not booking any comp until the exit happens.
That's right.
So very different accounting, very different impact, very complicated stuff. So appreciate you going through that, Nick. You know, obviously these are only some of the issues that portcos deal with. A lot of times, as you mentioned earlier, there's debt involved. A lot of times that gets restructured. Also a very complicated area of GAAP.
Yep.
A lot of SEC considerations that go into some of those exit events.
Right.
So we don't have time to get into that on this podcast, but it is in the portfolio company publication that we put out in November, acquisition to exit, aptly named. So you know, check that out. And obviously, if you are dealing with these highly complicated instruments, you know, Nick and I are available for a conversation and to help you figure out what the accounting answer might be. And so, Nick, with that, you know, thanks for being here and sharing your playbook with us.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
A huge thanks to Nick Bergmeier for navigating us through the portco journey, from acquisition all the way through exit. And look, whether you just finished a full episode and want a quick recap, or you're tuning in just for the highlights, allow me to crystallize my key takeaways from our conversation. First, for a portfolio company, accounting really is a strategy, because a future exit is not a possibility, but a certainty. And every foundational choice must be made with that end goal in mind. This means treating decisions around your legal entity structure, your compensation arrangements, and your accounting policies, like whether to elect private company alternatives or not, not as matters of short-term convenience, but as critical long-term decisions that directly impact the timing, cost, and success of a future exit, whether it's an IPO, a strategic sale, or otherwise. The most successful portfolio companies tend to be those that operate as if they are public ready from day one. And that applies to the accounting. Second, get the acquisition accounting right, because you really only get one chance at this. And the initial structure of the deal, specifically whether a new holding company or NewCo, as we like to call it, is involved, can have major accounting ramifications. The first step here is to determine whether this NewCo is substantive, which is a highly judgmental area of GAAP. But that can be the difference between being required to apply purchase accounting versus having the option to do so. And if you do find yourself weighing this option, it's important to think about what you want those financial statements to look like upon an exit. Having a single clean set of books that aligns with the PE firm's investment is usually the clearest way to align your financial reporting with the needs of those future investors or acquirers. But of course, this comes with a trade-off. In this case, the cost of applying acquisition accounting and the future drag on earnings that it creates from all that extra depreciation and amortization. And finally, make sure you think through the accounting for your compensation plans before you finalize them. While the goal is obviously to motivate management to drive towards an exit, the accounting treatment can take many different paths, not all of which are typically considered desirable. If the awards qualify for equity classification, then you lock in the amount of comp expense on the day they're granted. This expense can either be recognized, consistently over some period of time or deferred until the exit happens, depending on how the vesting conditions are structured. Alternatively, liability classified awards are going to be much more volatile. If vesting's tied to the exit, then the amount of expense is generally the value as of the exit date as opposed to the grant date. And if the expense is recognized prior to an exit, then you'll typically find yourself in this mark-to-market situation for measuring the amount of compensation expense. So liability versus equity is critical here. And be especially wary of repurchase features, as those are often the primary trigger for liability classification in these types of situations. So with that, I'm Nick Tricarci, and that's The Bottom Line. If you want to go deeper on this topic, and there's a lot to dive into, I highly recommend checking out the From Acquisition to Exit publication that we referenced throughout the episode. We put the link in the show notes. And for more insights, specifically for companies like the ones we discussed, I also want to recommend checking out KPMG Private, which is our dedicated practice that helps private companies and PE-backed businesses prepare for their next stage of growth or that eventual exit. You'll find a link to that in the show notes as well. And of course, be sure to subscribe, leave us a review, and please reach out if there are other topics you want us to tackle in future episodes. Thank you for listening, and we will talk to you later.